This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And let's begin by stipulating that every listener to Talk of the Nation is uniquely individual, a person whose choices are completely unaffected by marketing. That being said, for 2008, bottled water is out, spicy food is in, there's a streamlined trend in fashion, so pencil skirts are hot, pleated minis, so last year. Even if you don't subscribe to Vogue, you cannot avoid the latest trends. But where do they come from? Who decides what's the new black in fashion, food, or music, and how do companies sell us those images? Later in the program, we'll talk about the next big thing in ideas for 2008. What will thinkers contemplate in the new year, and how will they do it? But first, the making of a trend. How do you know when to buy Uggs? How do you know that the new black is black? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Douglas Rushkoff. He's a trend watcher and author of Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. He's in our New York Bureau. Happy New Year.
Hi, good to be with you.
And how are new trends identified or developed?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by a trend. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, a real trend would be like people are using email or people care about the environment. You know, those are trends. In a way, what we're talking about more are fads, you know,
okay,
like wearing Crocs or something like that. And there's a few ways that these things happen. I mean, sometimes they're identified almost randomly and then fed back to the culture through advertisements, and then they actually become more popular. So,
Let's go through that again. Identified almost randomly. How does that
right,
happen?
Like a let's say you've got an area of the city that's considered cool. You know, you've got poor artists living there, and they buy their clothes at thrift stores because they can't even afford regular clothes. Well, the clothes that will be most worn on the street in that area are going to be whatever was trendy probably 10 or 12 years ago and is now ending up in the thrift stores. So then one of the trend watching agencies will send some college kids out with Polaroid cameras to find out what's the new trend, what's happening on the street. And then these kids will go around and take pictures of the artsy people in the cool neighborhood wearing stuff from the thrift store from 10 years ago and bring it back. Then those photos will get scanned onto a website, and then the makers over at, you know, Levi's and H&M and The Gap, the people that are, you know, trying to come up with what fashion is going to appeal to kids in the future will base their fashions on those pictures that they've seen. And then all of a sudden, what some person bought at a thrift store ends up being in an ad in Rolling Stone and looked at by impressionable kids and told basically, that's what you're supposed to wear. Or that's what will end up on the kids, you know, on The Real World on MTV or on MTV Spring Break.
So because the jeans that somebody wore 20 years ago, 15 years ago are now torn, somebody buys them and we're advertised now torn jeans.
Right. I mean, it can happen that way, where something sort of random is just fed back into the culture. Sometimes there's something, a genuine trend or a movement like, say, the grunge movement in Seattle in the mid-90s. You know, that was actually a movement that was about resisting trends. So kids wore the most, you know, beat up and non-commercial, non-trendy clothes they could find until, of course, you know, clothing manufacturers decide, well, that's what we're going to make our clothes look like. And, you know, once everything at the thrift store has already been bought up that looks like that, now you've got to go to the mall and buy it from, you know, from a manufacturer.
And there are some areas, I guess, like that, where it seems what people are looking for, the manufacturers are are looking for some degree of authenticity. This is sort of real. On the other hand, you look at, haute couture, and they'll have none of that. Their trends don't come from the street. They come from the, you know, minds of highly paid designers.
Well, it depends. You know, sometimes some of those highly paid designers are paid because they're able to interpret, you know, the bottom-up fashion from the street. That's precisely their skill. I mean, I think there will always be interest in and a market in designers who actually design. I mean, very few, you know, sportswear companies or even music companies, record companies, you know, most of our cultural production now does not result from an expert in that form coming up with something, but rather a group of marketers trying to figure out what can we sell. And you know, it's kind of a sad state for culture that there's so little. And if there is something, you know, if there is a new cultural idea, a new kind of music, a new kind of design, usually marketers or a major company will jump on that so fast that it doesn't really have time to develop into what it could have been had it had time to really germinate and develop.
So by grabbing it and then mass marketing it, you sort of frozen it in time and it won't grow from there.
Right.
Uh-huh. And is it possible that these sleek marketing machines can sell us almost anything?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it works about half the time, you know, which probably means that they're not really any better at selling anything than anybody else. But you know, sometimes I would argue sometimes things do catch on that may not have caught on were they, you know, had they not capitalized on something else. And most of the time, the people who are marketing trends by piggybacking them on another trend. So, you know, I'm trying to get people to listen to a new kind of music or use a new product or wear a new makeup. I'm going to look and say, well, what are kids doing today? You know, well, today they're on Facebook. Yesterday they were on, MySpace. Or the day before they were on, Namester or, you know, who knows what it was. You try to find the thing that is the trend and then hop on that, you know, and become associated with, be the first person to market in whatever that new space is. You know, and sometimes you can. I mean, I think the net effect is kind of the cumulative effect of all this marketing is more interesting to me than any particular one. I mean, what does it mean if the parties you go to in college are frequented not just by friends, but by friends who are being paid by a sneaker company to wear a certain shoe, or friends who are being
paid
by—
Which would be viral marketing.
Right, or what they're calling viral marketing. It's not really viral so much. It's as just a really diffusion marketing, getting cool kids to do things and the hopes that it's going to diffuse down to other kids. I mean, what's the net effect of that on culture? What does it mean to be, you know, to be watching television where really every decision of every character, whether they're in a fiction show or in a so-called reality show, is really based on who has paid for that decision to be made? You know, what does it mean when our consumer choices themselves are the things we think of as trends rather than our personal choices, when what we have in common as people really are these giant national brands that we're going to subscribe to rather than whatever might be going on, you know, in our town or between us.
Our guest is Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and let us know, where do you find trends? Are you marketed to, and does it work? How do you know when to buy Uggs? When is it the right time to decide that black is the new black? And it seems to me, Douglas Rushkoff, you're still saying that decisions are being made in big companies.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a feedback loop going on where big companies are trying to mirror what they think, for the most part, young trend-setting people want. And young trend-setting people are sort of desperately perusing media for reflections of themselves. They want to see themselves in there. They want to get on TV. You know, you want to get on the real world. There's this sort of an aspirational loop that goes on where they pay, you know, young people a lot of money to go figure out what's next. And young people are spending a lot of time and energy trying to figure out what's next. So in some sense, they're chasing the same thing. What I'm kind of calling for in my own books and my own work is some human intervention in this. In other words, what about someone making a more conscious choice about what kind of music do we actually want to make? You know, and those people are kind of few and far between right now.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Kevin. Kevin calling us from Knoxville in Tennessee.
Hi there. To note that some ideas seem to generate almost spontaneously. They're meme-like ideas, and I think they come about because certain elements of the culture have led people independently to come up with the same thought, the same concept.
Give us a for instance, Kevin?
Yes, I do. Years ago, back before, I'm a computer programmer, and back before Windows, about four or five people came up with the idea of creating programs that would allow you to draw a data entry screen on a computer. And I was one of those people, and unfortunately I was about 6 or 7 months late. But nevertheless, it was just suddenly these three or four programs burst on the scene all at the same time, almost simultaneously, and from people who weren't working together. Just this, things had suddenly coalesced to a point where it became an almost obvious idea.
I wonder, are there examples of that, Douglas Rushkoff?
I mean, and those are what you would call true trends. In other words, those are that kind of simultaneous realization. Very often it requires a trigger point. I mean, I wrote a book back when early 90s called Media Virus, which kind of created this whole viral marketing thing, which I regret. What I was really looking at was how ideas really do almost spontaneously emerge and how they become contagious when the conditions are right. And all it really takes then is sort of one galvanizing event, one trigger point, and then a whole bunch of people realize that they've been thinking the same way. I mean, at the time, the virus I was writing a lot about was the Rodney King tape. You know, the Rodney King tape where a black guy's getting beaten by white cops in Los Angeles. It wasn't even that image was so terribly unique or provocative, but that there was a growing sense that the plight of young urban blacks was similar in a lot of different places. I mean, it ended up leading to rioting in, you know, 12 cities across America. It was a trigger point.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it also links to the idea that video cameras had suddenly appeared, and so it was possible to do that.
Right. Yeah, so now, that's the reason why the story spread. I mean, this is the fun. That's why I said the other thing wasn't really viral media. The reason why this was truly viral media was the thing that let that story spread was that a camcorder had been used. There was a great full-page ad for, I think it was Sony camcorders after that had happened, that showed a black hand holding a camcorder saying, "The power's in your hand." The reason that story spread was because there was a camcorder that caught a remarkable scene, not just because a guy was getting beaten.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call. And next time you get a great idea, jump on it.
I will.
We're talking about what's hot, but how do you know what it's hot? We'll talk with Ima Zandl and Tina Wells. They're both experts on the telling the temperature of a trend. And we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about trends this hour and where they come from. Some food trends to watch out for in 2008. Carbs are the new Uggs. French fries are back and crispier than ever. So is caffeine. You can get it in your donuts, your bagels, and your potato chips. Our guest is Douglas Rushkoff. He's a trend watcher and author of Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. Of course, we want to hear from TOTN trend watchers. Join the conversation. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Trends are especially important in the world of marketing, but when Fortune 500 CEOs need an image facelift, they don't pick up the latest copy of Elle, they hire someone. Ima Zandl is principal of the Zandl Group, a research firm that specializes in trend forecasting, and she joins us today from her office in Manhattan. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And how do you forecast trends?
It's not just one thing or where we go out in the street and we look for what's cool. I mean, basically, we have a large network of really forward-looking tastemakers who we've worked with for, you know, a long period of time. So we rely on some of the things that they tell us. We also have sort of a group of people who are like experts in different areas who we consult with. And then most of our work that we do with our clients, we have a very high-level client involvement. So when they are, you know, sitting across from, you know, tastemakers or experts, they're able to really sort of see things that maybe are missing in their own businesses or, you know, trends maybe that they've been aware of, but they're not aware of how these trends may be evolving. So it's not something that you dip your toe in just once. It's something that's really an ongoing.
Is tastemaker an official job title? I mean, if on their IRS forms, they you know, occupation, tastemaker?
No. I mean, that's a term that we use for certain people who, you know, we just feel whether it's, you know, in food or it's in, like, nightlife or, you know, fashion or hospitality or whatever. I mean, people who put up certain hotels or whatever, and just people who have consistently sort of been ahead of, you know, where the rest of us are. Mm-hmm. So I just think those are great people to tap into.
In your experience, where are most trends originating these days? Is it, as Douglas Rushkoff was telling us, in some cases that they're found on the street and then promptly promoted?
I mean, some things happen that way. I think one of the, I mean, I've been doing this for over 20 years now, and I think one of the things that has really changed over time is that trends used to just come sort of, I mean, more or less, it was sort of like a pyramid. You'd have like the top of the pyramid, whereas I think now, I think trends are much more, it's like more like a petri dish where, you know, because everyone has access to information now. I mean, you can go online, everyone's going on Wikipedia, everyone is finding out really eclectic bits of information about everything. So it's, I don't think it's as straightforward anymore, and certain things can come from the bottom up, and then other things really still come, you know, top down.
And does it vary in terms of, are the more expensive things necessarily the top down things?
Not always, but I mean, obviously, you know, certain things you do have to have an amount of money and able to be, you know, in order to be able to participate. So, for those things, but
well, obviously yachts, but you know, and high fashion. In terms of food, though, I mean, would you represent, for example, a snack food company?
I mean, we have worked with snack food companies.
And how is it that, you know, is the trend to have garlic licorice this year as opposed to just plain old Doritos?
Well, I think actually it's sort of interesting with food. And people's tastes in food take much longer to change than, for example, you know, what they're going to wear. But we are finding that more sort of mainstream food companies are looking for more faddish things because I think they tend to sort of, you know, juice up, you know, their lineup and maybe make it like a little more exciting than in the past. And so, and while, for example, you know, diet has always been sort of a long-standing trend. I mean, there's always been, for a long time, sort of like an obesity problem. But what I think are the sort of the fads in that category are all the different diets that come along. So, you know, one year it's carbs, and then one year it's this, and one year it's the next. So those are really sort of the trends that, I mean, the trend is the sort of obesity and people wanting to be, you know, fit and healthy. And then the fads within that are the different approaches people have to losing weight.
Well, let's get some more callers in on the conversation, and we'll go to Bob in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah, hi, Neil. Thanks for taking a call.
Thanks.
My observation is that and this is mostly about fashion and music trends and that kind of thing in the pop culture, that it seems to be based on our society has this obsessive pursuit for coolness or hipness, and often that's...
And for youth, I think you could throw that in.
For youth, very much so. And it's often based, being cool is based on something superficial or external that we find rather than something that we accomplish or do, like our clothes or what music we're into or what latest pop star we've discovered that no one else has discovered. And the thing I'd be interested in hearing a comment on is that the print and electronic media seems to both feed off of this, looking for what it is that we've discovered and then reporting on it, and then that somehow it acts as an accelerant and feeds it, kind of like whatever's in the media, because it's in the media, is important, and you've got this cycle going. You know?
Douglas Rushkoff, let me ask you about that sort of self-reinforcing loop that I think Bob was talking about.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I would agree. I mean, the fact is, you know, we've been trained as a culture to consume to feel cool as opposed to produce to feel cool. You know, that's really what, you know, what America's been about, you know, since the Second World War, is to create a culture of consumers so that, you know, we don't feel, you can't just be, you know, without buying CKB. You know, you have to have something in order to feel cool. And that is superficial. The interesting thing about the internet to me is that, you know, a lot of our media consumption and our consumptive behavior ends up either being or maybe just looking like, you know, production. You know, so, you know, Time magazine will put a little mirror on the cover and say, you know, we've been successful. We're the person of the year now. And, you know, you've had your revolution. But, you know, what are we really doing? Well, now we're paying the same corporation to, you know, go online and have server space in order to create media instead of just to, you know, download or watch media. So in that sense, I mean, we're really always consuming in order to establish an identity, or in order to have some way of really interfacing with other people, in a fashion that seems cool or with it. Or
let me ask Irma Zandel about this. If there's for example an advertisement with a picture of a person, the agency and the company all decide is very cool wearing a watch, is the idea that you can acquire a certain degree of cool by buying that same watch?
Well, I mean, yes, that goes without saying, because, I mean, you're more like, I mean, I think most of us are more likely to maybe buy something off somebody who looks, you know, cool or nice or whatever. But I want to make sort of a distinction between, like, cool and a trend. I mean, there are certain trends that are cool, but there's a lot of trends that have nothing to do with cool per se, because, I mean, obviously it's a trend that we have an aging population and everything that entails, but that's not necessarily, you know, in that sort of cool vernacular. So, I mean, I think there's a distinction, but normally the media, when they talk about trends, it sort of automatically turns into, well, of course, this is like whatever the latest pop culture trivia thing is.
It's an important distinction. It's what I was trying to draw at the beginning. And then how corporations relate to that distinction is important, too. So if a responsible trend watcher says, look, people are really concerned about the environment now. Now it's up to the corporation to decide, well, do I want to now appeal to that sensibility, to that trend, by making things that feel green or that act green or that make you feel like you're part of green? Or do I want to help people actually be green? And, you know, that's really up to the corporation that a trend person advises more than the trend watcher himself.
Okay.
Bob? Yes, and in that, I mean, I think for almost every company that's out there, there's going to be, in every category, they're going to tap into trends, maybe the same trend in a different way, based on, you know, whether it's a very mainstream company versus somebody who's like a more, you know, it's more niche, or whether or not, you know, it's maybe like more high priced. That tends to often be more maybe forward than, I mean, you'll see certain things at Whole Foods before you're going to see them necessarily
at the A&P.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bob, thanks very much for the call.
And thanks for taking it, Neil.
And here's an email from Kim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I just want to know, dear God, when will Ugg boots finally be out?
Oh, my God, they're so back in. It's so horrific to me. There's a new Ugg store in Soho, and I was walking down the street, and there's a line of about 50 people, and I'm like, goodness, what is this line for? And it's for Ugg boots.
Is the Yeti look, adds Kim, really that hot? And I guess for some people it is.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Irma Zandel, thanks so much for your time today.
You're more than welcome.
Irma Zandel, principal of the Zandel Group, an expert on consumer behavior and trend forecasting, with us from her office in New York. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Sunny. Sunny with us from Benton Harbor in Michigan.
Hi. Well, I'm 18, and I perceive fashion with the aphorism that there's nothing new under the sun. Fashion's often recycled and trends often reoccur, such as like the high-waisted jeans, the leggings, tunics, and I think that marketing is extremely successful in influencing the consumer's psychographic tendencies of my generation's demographic. Like, for example, all of my friends own Ugg boots, they're Ugg knockoff boots, and I agree with the previous emailer, and I think also that Crocs need to be done away with as well. Personally, I try to shy away from tens. I'm a huge aficionado of J. Crew classic style. And I think the telling factor is that my mom often comments to me that she wore the same garment that I want to buy in the store in the 70s. Also, lastly, I disagree that one has to be financially well off in order to be considered trendy.
Oh, no, on some things. I think we were talking about, you know, high-scale watches and that sort of thing. I don't think she was talking about things in general. But let me ask you, Douglas Rushkoff, the point that, just to dispute you just a tiny little bit, Sonny, not all trends come back. I think the narrow jacket is safely placed away in history. But Douglas Rushkoff, she's right. A lot of these things do tend to recycle.
Well, because there's only so many things. I mean, the object of the corporations who are attempting to lead trends is not to somehow make people look sexier or to fulfill people's need for appropriate fashion, but rather to keep people buying clothes. You know, the idea with these, even these food companies, you know, the reason they want to come out with more new trendy fad food items is because they have shareholders that are looking at the metric of how many new products did they get on the shelf, how many successful launches were there this year. It's not about feeding people or sustaining their company. It's about meeting certain target metrics. So if share price is going to go up based on how many new product launches there were, then they've got to launch a new product whether people need a new food product or not. Mm-hmm. So that's going to mean finding, you know, new marshmallow, you know, jelly.
Sonny, thanks very much for the call. We're talking about trends today on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's hear from another trend forecaster. Tina Wells is CEO and founder of Buzz Marketing Group. She joins us today from her home in New Jersey. Happy New Year. Nice to have you on the program today.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you for having me.
And I guess we're continuing to ask the question, where do trends come from? How do you research them?
Well, I am lucky enough to have a network of 9,000 youth all over the world called our Buzz Spotters that help me track trends. So, you know, my network is based in 20 countries.
And if 75% of them suddenly realize that everybody's wearing red plastic handbags, then that's suddenly a trend.
Well, it's the start of one. You know, I think that a lot of what I do is sort of studying trend, you know, micro and macro trends and looking at, you know, for years we've seen the trend of iPod, but I think the bigger trend is something I would call mass exclusivity, which is noticing that now mass products are made to have some sort of exclusive value. So it's that idea that everyone can have the same thing, yet it's just for me.
Yeah, and I understand you also work with focus groups that can include girls as young as 7 years old.
Yes, we do.
How come?
We work with a lot of toy companies, and you know, younger tweens are really interesting when it comes to, you know, whether it's developing new TV shows for them or developing even new recording artists that target them. It's, you know, important to both get their opinion, I think, and their parents' opinions as well.
And can you tell us, we're just starting a new year, what's trendy today and how did you find out about it?
What's trendy today? You know, I think a lot, like I've been talking a lot about mass exclusivity. I think it's a huge trend. You see sites like Nike ID, Levi's now, where you can customize products for yourself. You know, one of the other trends I coined is called Warholism, meaning that everyone believes that they can be famous at some point in their lives, whether it's through YouTube or having more friends than anyone on Facebook or MySpace. I think that, you know, fame is a very attainable thing these days.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Joshua. Joshua with us from Utica, New York.
Hello?
Staying warm, huh, Josh?
Yes, hello?
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I would just like to make a comment real quick. I'm 16-year-old high school junior, and I find it that very, very often in media and popular culture, things, music and clothing styles are very, very often categorized, and I'd like to hear a comment on how, whether or not you think this is a classification not just of music and of dressing styles, but of people. And
I see. So characterize, you know, a certain style of clothes as hip-hop, and therefore you are a hip-hop person if you wear them?
Exactly.
I take it you're not a buzz spotter, Josh. Okay, let's hear from Tina Wells on that.
Actually, we classify our buzz spotters into four groups. I call techies, preppies, alternatives, and independents. And so I think you'll find hip-hop kids in an alternative or independent category. But, you know, that really is a classification based on numerous things, not just fashion and, you know, entertainment choices, but really lifestyle choices, you know, choices you make when it comes to even how you shop. You know, are you an early adopter? Are you a late adopter? Are you, you know, into mass retail locations? Are you more of a boutique or vintage shopper? So, you know, I think that it is true. We definitely develop profiles of people, and those profiles really help us make distinctions about, you know, what these different target groups or tribes, as they're sometimes called, would be interested in.
Josh, good question. I think you should be a buzz spotter.
I absolutely think he should as well.
Thanks very much for the call. Tina Wells, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Tina Wells, CEO and founder of Buzz Marketing Group, with us from her home in New Jersey. And Douglas Rushkoff, thank you for your time today, too.
Thanks for having me.
Douglas Rushkoff was at our bureau in New York. He's the author of Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. When we come back, our final installment in the next big thing business, Who's Picking Trends? We're talking about ideas with philosophy, the subject. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.